I'm Lauren Sherman, the writer behind Puck's Fashion and Beauty Memo line sheet, and I'd like to welcome you to my new show, Fashion People. On every episode of Fashion People, I'll be talking to insiders about the stuff we're all whispering between the press releases, from M&A rumors to celebrity stylist dish to the future of legacy media. Be sure to follow and listen to Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, available on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Gerald Cotton was Bitcoin's Bernie Madoff. He ran Canada's biggest crypto exchange, Quadriga, like it was a small-time Ponzi scheme, embezzling hundreds of millions of dollars from his customers, and then gambling most of it away. But the people who knew him say they had no idea what he was up to. For this episode, I spoke with a friend of Jerry's, a Bitcoin security expert named Michael Perklin. Now, Jerry didn't have many close friends, but according to someone who knew him well, he thought very highly of Michael. So I asked Michael what he thought of Jerry when he was alive and what he thinks of him now. I'm Aaron Lammer. Welcome to Exit Scam, a podcast about a mysterious death and a missing fortune. This is part 5, The Old Friend. Could you tell me your name and what you've been doing professionally?
Sure. So my name is Michael Perklin. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer of Shapeshift by day. Shapeshift is a platform that allows you to send, receive, and trade Bitcoin.
So would it be safe to say that you are involved in security in the crypto space?
Yes, I first got involved with blockchain technology in late 2010. And so it's almost a full 10 years now that I've been working with Bitcoin, Ethereum, and related technologies.
When did you first come across Gerald Cotton?
When I decided to start working on Bitcoin full time, I started my own Bitcoin-focused digital investigative firm. And my small burgeoning consultancy needed an office. So I found a co-working space downtown Toronto, and I rented a desk there. It's one of those places where, you know, if you pay so much a month, you get access to their Wi-Fi, their printer, their tea kettle, and, you know, away you go, and you get a desk. So Jerry was working out of this co-working space as well, which I thought was surprising because he was running a Bitcoin exchange. But as I talked to him a little bit more, I understood that the headquarters were in Vancouver, but he has family near the Toronto area, so he comes to Toronto semi-frequently, and having a co-working space rather than a full-on office is cheaper to maintain, and it suited his flexible work style.
What were your interactions at the co-working space like? What was Jerry like as a guy to sit next to?
I enjoyed our conversations. He was a smart guy, a humble guy. Whenever we talk about a variety of computer science problems that were solved or that needed to be solved, I remember discussing with Gerald Cotton, with Vitalik Buterin, and with Jeff Coleman. The four of us were working together in the co-working space, and we were trying to solve distributed identity. He was keeping up with all the other computer scientists in the room.
Did Jerry know Vitalik Buterin outside of the co-working space? For people listening, Vitalik Buterin is the founder of Ethereum.
I don't know, but they definitely knew of each other. They definitely met. We were all working in the same co-working space back in Toronto in 2014. Ethereum was launched in that co-working space.
What did Jerry think about Ethereum and other altcoins?
Great question. I actually remember this one. At the time, like most people, I was a Bitcoin maximalist. Jerry was different. Jerry said, yeah, I mean, I know that Bitcoin is always going to be on top, but, you know, to the extent that this coin or that coin has some value and somebody wants to trade it, you know, what's the harm in me facilitating that? He had a very capitalist view on that. And that actually mirrored some of the other political views that I remember him sharing, municipal politics at the time for the election of famed mayor Rob Ford.
What were Jerry's politics?
Jerry never shared his actual opinions on politics. He, whether it was just because he wasn't comfortable enough to share it, or he recognized that the moment he starts sharing an opinion that's the opposite of anyone else in the room, now it becomes a him versus them. And his whole purpose at all these meetups was to attract interest into his platform. And if he would be, you know, the person on the other side of the political spectrum, somebody may choose not to put money on his platform. So he actually overheard me recommending his exchange to somebody else at one of the Bitcoin meetups. I had only used Quadriga once or twice, but when I was talking to somebody new who was asking about Bitcoin, I said, oh yeah, you could sign up at CA Vertex, but also there's another exchange, Quadriga. It looks like it's easier to use. He overheard that conversation. And the next morning he said, hey, so do you remember that guy that you told to use Quadriga? Well, they ended up creating an account last night after the meetup, and they deposited a rather significant amount of Bitcoin. They're doing business on my platform because of you. I want to give you the referral for that. There's a referral system, or there was a referral system on Quadriga where, you know, if you share your link with somebody and they sign up, you get a small fraction of a penny of their trade volume. He wanted that to be tracked to me because it was technically me who referred him, even though it was verbally and not by a link. So he linked that up, and that was the first time that I really, I guess, started referring people to his exchange. It was mostly in passing verbally.
Did you become a customer to his exchange?
I started using his exchange in 2014 and stopped using it when it shut down in early 2019.
And so you were at the co-working space with him. Would you hang out? Would you have lunch?
I had lunch with him a couple of times. We commiserated over our respective bodies and their inabilities to process one compound or another. I myself, I don't tolerate people who are intolerant of others, and I also don't tolerate lactose. But Jerry didn't tolerate people who are intolerant of others, and his body didn't tolerate gluten. So we joked about that, and yeah, he would order his burgers without buns, and I would order my burgers without cheese, but we'd eat burgers the same. And I mentioned to him that I had another friend who has Crohn's disease, and she's, you know, very healthy and living with it, and he seemed that he had no problems with it either.
Did you and Jerry ever talk about you consulting on Quadriga?
I definitely did offer my services, because at the time I did security work for CA Vertex, the largest Canadian exchange for the Ethereum Foundation and for a variety of other clients. So I definitely had the track record of delivering on my my security consulting. But for one reason or another, Jerry never took me up on my offers. I just assumed it was either because Quadriga didn't have a lot of money at the time, because it was a very new exchange, so he didn't want to pay for a consultant. Or maybe one of the many other people that he's working with is already a security expert and is providing all that stuff in-house. I didn't dive too deep into why he said no. I just knew he said no, and I was like, okay, well, let's go to lunch.
So you're sitting there, you're investigating hacking, crime, thefts. Did you discuss any of this stuff with Jerry over these lunches?
I did talk about one particular case that led me to London and then Dubai, chasing a criminal who stole a lot of Bitcoin from another exchange. I touched on some of the ways that I was able to identify him and prove that he stole this amount of money and not that amount of money, and how the blockchain forensics was able to do that. And he was interested in that. I assumed, just as somebody who runs a Bitcoin business and who at some point might need to worry about investigating, you know, the source of funds, or, you know, if something gets stolen, how can you track all this? I assumed it was just professional interest in that. But now, of course, after all this, maybe he was taking a keen interest because the allegations are true and he did squirrel away all this money and is somehow living in secret, spending it all.
Did Jerry ever say or do anything that made you suspicious?
Not quite. So we wanted to make an educational conference that would teach people relevant skills about Bitcoin. For accountants, for lawyers, how do you deal with anti-money laundering laws? For police officers and investigators, how do you trace Bitcoins and trace crimes so that you can catch the bad guys? We wanted to have an exchange there. So Jerry agreed to sponsor C4 for this conference. I believe the Quadriga sponsorship amount was 10,000 Canadian dollars, which wasn't nothing at the time. Well, I guess it's still nothing today, but it wasn't like a peanut investment is what I'm saying. Quadriga took it seriously, and they even advertised on their website that every single one of their staff members was a certified Bitcoin professional, and they only hire CBPs at Quadriga. So it was great marketing for us. It was a great way for our attendees to get onboarded right then and there with an exchange. When it came to the day of the conference, he didn't show up. I emailed him saying, hey, your booth is currently empty. You paid $10,000 for it. What's up? If you can't make it, maybe you can send another one of your staff members in your place. Really, we just need someone to, you know, check IDs and onboard like hundreds of customers to your exchange. Like, this is something that I'm sure you want to do. In the end, I never found out why he didn't show up. But I guess when all this was surfacing about Quadriga and the allegations that, you know, Jerry took the money rather than it being inaccessible, one thing that I know would be consistent is at a conference where you know there are dozens of police officers and cybercrime investigators attending to learn how to trace Bitcoin for their investigations. If you are scamming, you know, millions of people around Canada with your fake exchange, the last thing you'd want to do is show your face and rub shoulders with the very people who would likely be tasked with investigating you if your jig comes up. So that's a speculation of why he might not have shown up.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
And I want to tell you about a podcast I think you're going to love.
Who Weekly is a podcast about everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't.
Does celebrity news stress you out?
Are there too many people you've literally never heard of?
Check out Who Weekly, a podcast hosted by Lindsay Weber and me, Bobby Finger.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we'll answer the most burning listener queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly on the Odyssey app or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Do you remember the last time you saw Jerry?
I last saw Jerry, it would have been December 2016. It was shortly before I left Toronto to work at Shapeshift full-time. And one of the last things that I needed to do was essentially close down my Quadriga account and get all the funds taken out of there before I can, you know, get on the plane and leave Toronto. I was on a tight deadline. And in the past, Jerry had, I guess, been very friendly to me with my deposits and withdrawals with Quadriga because he knew who I was, he knew where I worked, he knew where I lived, he'd been in my home. So we agreed to meet in a Starbucks. I met him in person. He gave me the check in my hand. We shared a coffee and a tea together. And then we went on our ways. I said, yeah, I don't know when I'm going to be back in Toronto, but I'll hit you up when I am. And I never saw him after that.
What was your reaction when you first heard about his death?
When I first heard that Jerry had passed away, I thought it was a huge shame. Jerry was only ever a good guy. I've only ever seen him being a nice man. My first reaction was, oh man, that sucks. The shitty things always happen to the good people.
Did you know Jennifer Robertson?
Never heard the name. It was never mentioned. It surprised me when I learned that he was married. After I read that he had passed away, I learned that he was married in the year prior. He never mentioned her.
After he died, what was the general sentiment in the Bitcoin community?
online, people were saying that he's an exit scammer and he faked his own death and he stole everyone's money. And I was like, no, there's no way he did that. He doesn't seem like that type of person. let's not drag a man's name through the mud when we don't know what happened. You know, this sucks. The money's currently inaccessible, but let's wait to hear more information before we jump to any conclusions. And, you know, report after report would come out, and each time I would defend Jerry's name because I knew him. He never seemed like a bad guy. He never did anything to me that would indicate that he was a bad actor. So Ernst & Young is acting as the independent monitor between Quadriga on one side and all the users on the other side. Now, the monitor reports that were released by E&Y have said a lot of stuff, and a lot of it is rather jaw-dropping evidence that they found that shows just at the very least how poorly Jerry ran Quadriga from a fiscally responsible perspective, but at most just how egregious his crimes were and how brazen he was in stealing his customers' money. But then when I read that monitor report that outlined the lack of separation between Quadriga funds and user funds, paying contractor bills with withdrawals of user funds rather than coming out of Quadriga balances, him withdrawing user funds and depositing it on another exchange to make margin leveraged bets, just like line after line after line of that monitor report left my jaw dropping and dropping and dropping. And I guess at some point mid-2019, my tune changed from, let's not jump to any conclusions, guys, Jerry is a good guy unless proven otherwise, to, oh wow, that was clearly an exit scam. He knowingly performed actions that essentially defrauded the users of his exchange. And I think the only reason why I got out unscathed is because over the years, I had referred probably thousands of people to the exchange, whether it be from my tweets, my emails, some of my clients that I would work with, family, friends, or people who I just mentioned it to at a meetup. And he knew that by keeping me happy, it would likely mean more money for him in the long run.
And a lot of the people who you referred to Quadriga must have lost a lot of money. Did any of that come back on you?
Nobody blames me. A lot of people I know did lose a lot of money. I lost some money as well, though thankfully in the grand scheme of things, it wasn't a lot. But some of my friends and family, they deposited, traded, and withdrew within an hour. But that withdrawal was never processed. And they waited and they waited and they pinged support, and then they pinged me, and I pinged Jerry by text message, and it's like, hey, a buddy of mine's wondering why the withdrawal isn't happening. And like, all in, if I were to add up all the people that I know who have shared with me, I lost X dollars, I lost Y dollars, it's in the millions.
So now that you've read the Fifth Monitor's report, which you referred to, what is your understanding of what Jerry was up to this whole time?
My understanding may not match reality, but I believe that it was his intent from day one to get as much money for himself as he could. And while one way of doing that is to run a very successful and profitable business where you are taking all of your profits, the other way is to steal a lot of money from a lot of people. And by operating in the way that he did, creating these accounts to create fake volume, to raise the profile of his exchange, to attract more people and get those deposits in so that he can use those deposits for his own purposes. Like, for somebody to set things up so that they don't have a strict separation between somebody else's money and my money, that right there is not necessarily intent to deceive. But when you couple that with all the other actions described in that monitor report, there's no doubt in my mind, as the available balance in the exchange is getting lower and lower to the point where it is now starting to be noticed, magically, he is out of the picture. And if there was an opportune time to perform an exit scam, it was in December 2018. Again, I don't know that he did. As far as I know, as far as all your listeners know, he went to India and he died there. But like, just looking at the numbers, it's so coincidental that when the last bit of juice is squeezed out of the lemon and there's pretty much just a husk of what used to be left over, suddenly, oh, he's gone. Yeah, there's also no more money to be stolen. What a coincidence.
I'll ask point blank. Do you think he faked his death?
I think he's the type of person who could have if he chose to. In my conversations with him, he had a working familiarity with encryption and Tor and privacy. He had a working familiarity with hiding his identity online, and it was seemingly from whatever stuff he was doing before he got involved with Bitcoin, which I never really got any elaboration on. When he would come to my home, he said, yeah, I was just coming from my helicopter lesson. He was taking helicopter lessons and pilot's lessons to earn his licenses. Now, with these licenses, you are able to move from one small island in this country to another small island in that country without needing to go through a commercial airport where you have to show a passport and you have to show ID and there's a record of you moving from one to another. As long as you stay in countries and in areas where you don't really deal with the Western world that much, and if you have the skills of flight and you have the knowledge of online privacy and you have a big wealth of privacy coins in your cash, you don't need to worry about ever going to North America or Europe again. You can essentially retire and stay in the middle of the third world for the rest of your life. I don't know if I will ever be able to answer your question directly with yes or no. I think he did or I think he did not. But looking back with a new set of eyes on all the things that I saw while I was with him, nothing triggered a concern with me. But in hindsight, looking at how he didn't show up to my conference where there was a lot of cops there and how he was able to participate in very highly technical discussions that I was having with Vitalik and Jeff Coleman at the time. So he had this knowledge. And seeing the new skills he was acquiring for flying both helicopters and planes. And he definitely could have.
Did you read about all the stuff that Jerry got into before his Bitcoin days as a teenager and a young person online?
Yes, I did. I went down that rabbit hole myself one night, and if it was him, if for your listeners' benefit, there is a variety of forum posts that somebody is writing looking for help with designing this platform, what we believe could have been Quadriga, or help with list of credit card numbers and like laundering funds and a whole bunch of things like that on darknet forums specifically for those purposes. And people allege that these were Jerry's accounts, and it shows that he was performing money laundering and credit card fraud long before Quadriga was started.
We're talking about the handles Scepter and later Murdoch.
Yeah, he never mentioned any of those in any of my conversations with him, but it would be consistent with a variety of anecdotes of my conversations with him, because he already knew and understood PKI, public key infrastructure, very well. He understood encryption. He understood Tor and privacy and masking your location. Like, he understood all that very well seemingly before he even started with Quadriga. Now, if he was hanging out on these forums and he really was Scepter and Murdoch, then yeah, that's where he got that knowledge. Credit card numbers and expiry dates, people's home addresses, oftentimes these lists are used for identity theft and opening mortgages in other people's names, or for charging things to other people's credit cards and otherwise stealing money from people. And these users, Scepter and Murdoch, are communicating with other users, either requesting specific things or helping others perform these types of frauds against unsuspecting victims. I never saw any proof that these were Jerry's accounts, but I also, I mean, who knows? That could be.
Do you think Jerry set off to make a fraudulent exchange and succeeded? Or do you believe that he had good intentions and something went wrong?
No, I don't think that something went wrong at some point. Based on the information in the Monitor report, it was clear from the earliest days, he was setting up bots to fake trade volume to make it appear like his exchange was used a lot more than it was in reality. That's an intent to deceive your customers. Like right out of the gate, from the earliest days, he was deceiving people to enrich himself. He makes the name of a fake contractor. He pays that contractor for services rendered, but in reality, he's just moving money to himself. And then combine that with a bunch of apparently unprofitable trades on a platform, and now what looks like a really shitty trade is actually laundering the money. And indeed, if you read the Monitor report, they make reference to a number of recipients of larger sums of cryptocurrency. They don't name those recipients. Those recipients could have been accomplices, or they could have been Jerry himself. I don't think there was a breaking point where he turned from good to bad. If there was such a point, I think that point was before he opened Quadriga. And I think he was really good at projecting one image in person, which I saw as a very nice gentleman. But in reality, he was just putting on a nice mask to take as much money as he could.
Looking back, how do you feel about the statements you gave in support of Jerry?
Honestly, it's made me doubt my ability to assess someone's character. Over the years, I recommended this man's company to friends and family alike. I invited him into my home and I broke bread with him. Well, not bread. He didn't eat gluten. Figuratively, I shared alcohol with him. I shared meals with him. I played board games with him on my dining room table. Never once did I get any indication that he was stealing from everybody who I was recommending to his company. And I vehemently defended his reputation online in the first 4 or 5 months of this debacle, up until I read that Monitor report. And to everybody on Reddit and Twitter and Discord and all the other places where you have, I guess, fought on the other side of the verbal argument with me, where I was defending Jerry, I have to say to you, you were right. I was wrong. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have defended him. But I prefer to assume everything is on the up and up first and only assume the worst when there's a reason to. Ultimately, in this case, you guys were right. But then again, when you're just hit with the news that someone you know and that you spent time with just died, nothing really makes sense to you at that moment. So I didn't think anything untoward of it until after I read the Monitor report, and then I looked back and said, before there was more probability that it was just a crappy set of circumstances that made private keys unavailable to the remaining Quadriga staff. And then my likely narrative shifted to, now it's more likely that he actually did fake his death and he is off with all this absconded funds somewhere, hopping from island to island with his own personal plane. If anything, I think there's a higher chance that somebody killed him for what he knew and what he could expose of other people's crimes. that I think is a higher possibility than him just randomly dying innocently while also committing the crimes. When you're dealing with laundering money with multiple hundreds of millions of dollars, which is what Scepter was allegedly helping these people launder hundreds of millions of dollars. At that level, like, that's organized crime. That is, you know, that's the level where if you piss off the wrong person, you will have your life ended. So maybe that caught up to him. I think it's more likely that that stuff caught up to him than him dying innocently in India while opening up an orphanage. Who knows what happened to Jerry, if he really did die or not. My money now is on my belief that he is still alive, and he probably has just listened to this podcast and heard my words, and that makes me feel a bit creepy and unsettled.
On the next episode of Exit Scam.
And I asked her if she recalled the body of a Canadian coming through, and she immediately said, yes. I was asked to embalm his body, and I refused. At which point, of course, given all of the many questions about this case, kind of the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I was like, well, why?
Exit Scam was written and produced by me, Aaron Lammer, and Lane Brown. Mixing and additional editing by Martin D. Fowler. Show art and art direction by Mickey Duje. The theme song is by Francis and the Lights, and scoring from this episode was by Francis Starlight, Mark Allen Piccolo, Ross C. Manini, Martin D. Fowler, and myself. Our executive producers are Max Linsky, Lane Brown, and myself for Treats Media. Additional sound editing and producing by James Nicholson. Additional producing by Jacqueline Scurry. Thank you to Jake Schreier, Patty Greco, Evan Ratliff, Jenna Weiss-Berman, Joel Lovell, Lizzie Denahan, J.D. Crowley, Ann Garrett, Jay Kang. See you next week.